So this morning I'm going to introduce you to our new series that we're going to be looking at over the next 7 weeks. And before we launch into that, I just want to ask you a question. So I want to ask you, what is your favourite book or film and why? And you've got a couple of minutes to talk about it together and then we'll regroup. Okay, don't be like uber holy and say the Bible. It's a great book and it probably is one of your favourites, but think of something other than that and discuss it just for a couple of minutes, okay? Okay. Hopefully you've had a chance to talk about that. I don't know that I'm going to be able to shut you up now. I've got you onto books and films, but if you can shut up a bit, that would be great. I'm just joking. I'm just saying it's like, that's how to like get everybody off your off topic, isn't it? Give them a chance to talk right at the beginning of the talk. Anyway, hopefully you've had a chance to discuss that. And what I will imagine is that we've got a vast array of films and books that people have got as their favourites and loads of different reasons why they're your favourites. For me, the best films and books are those that have got layers. They're like an onion. There's like layer upon layer of stuff. And they're the sort of books or films that you read or you watch like for a second or a third time and you're like, oh, I never saw that the first time. And maybe that's something that you share. Maybe it's not. But that, for me, is always something that defines a book or a film that I enjoy. And today we're starting a series looking at the seven signs of John's Gospel. And I guess it goes without saying that John's Gospel is worth a read because it's in the Bible. I'm probably a bit biased about that because I'm a Christian. But that aside, the book of John is so well written. And I don't think I'd really realised that until I kind of started looking at this series, to be honest. But I've spent the last few weeks going deeper into its structure and its form and the way it's written, and it really is amazing. And it's kind of like when you watch and rewatch a film. When you read something and then you read it again, there's something else that comes out that you didn't necessarily see the first time. And I really hope that that will be your experience over the next 7 weeks as we look at this together. So we're going to do a really short overview of the book of John, and then we're going to talk about one of the signs that John talks about in his gospel. So I don't know how much you know about the book of John, but it was written by the apostle John, who describes himself in the gospel as the disciple whom Jesus loved, which isn't probably the most humble way to describe yourself. But I think, you know, he had a closeness and a depth of relationship with Jesus that gives him some authority as he writes about Jesus and his life. And in fact, it was John who, when Jesus was on the cross, it was John who Jesus asked to look after his mum when he died. And so that closeness and that depth of relationship was there. And it's thought to have been written somewhere between 50 and 85 AD. Nobody really knows exactly when, but that's kind of a ballpark time. So not too long after Jesus walked the earth. And it's written quite differently to the other Gospels. So in Matthew, Mark and Luke, you'll see some particular areas of focus. Whereas in John's Gospel, as you read through, you'll notice there's really long sections of kind of discussion and debate and conversations with groups and individuals. And through this, we see Jesus starting to reveal something of who he is. So this is like a brief overview. I've highlighted in yellow the things that we're going to look at in the next 7 weeks. So the first chapter of John starts with this introduction to Jesus, who's the one that has always been. He's not new on the scene. He's always been there right from the beginning of creation. And yet we see in that first chapter of John, it talks about the Word becoming flesh, about Jesus, who is the Word, coming to dwell among us on earth. And then we see John the Baptist start to introduce Jesus and say, this guy's coming and I'm not even fit to tie his sandals. And then later on in chapter one, Jesus starts to call his disciples and people start to recognize there's something different about this man and we need to follow him. And then the next section of the book is called The Signs, which is the bit that's highlighted in yellow, and there's seven of them. As you read through John, you'll start to realise there's a bit of a theme. Seven is a popular number in John's Gospel. These seven signs point to the biggest sign of all, which is the resurrection, which we celebrated last week, didn't we, with Easter. And as we go through these signs, what you'll start to see is a bit of a pattern. But John is a beautifully crafted book. So Tom Wright, I'm going to give a little plug for this book. If anyone wants to read something alongside the series, this book is called John for Everyone, and it's written by Tom Wright. It's really readable. I got it for about £1 secondhand on Amazon. It's always worth looking on new and used. You might have to pay a couple of quid postage, but it's really good, and it takes you through. And he says that this book is like a pool that's safe for a child to paddle in, but deep enough for an elephant to swim in. It makes you welcome. Indeed, millions have found that as they come closer to this book, the friend above all friends is coming out to meet them. And this is an amazing recommendation for a book, isn't it? That as we read through this book, that we're confronted with Jesus, and it's a Jesus who asks us, will you believe in me? That's the question that he asks us as we get to know him in John. A few other hints just as you're reading. There's a really good good video on the internet called, it's published by The Bible Project. I posted it on the Facebook group at the end of last week, so some of you might have seen that. But if you Google Bible Project John, there's an 8-minute video that comes up, and it's a really creative way of kind of giving you a bit of an overview of how John's Gospel works, and I'd recommend that because it might help you make sense a bit more of what you're going to hear over the next few weeks. So it will really help you also to read through John's Gospel as we study through, because we're not going to read all of the bits in between the signs, but as it says on the screen there, that generally what happens is that Jesus performs a sign or a miracle, and this kind of sparks some controversy, and then people have to make a choice about who Jesus is. And sometimes the controversy and the choices that people make aren't within the sign itself, if that makes sense, within the narrative itself. So reading around will help you. So the purpose of John's Gospel, why are we even looking at this? What's the point? I guess that the signs are moments when heaven touches earth. They're like clues in a treasure hunt that lead us to the ultimate sign, which is Jesus' resurrection. And John says himself that this book is written so that we might believe in Jesus, that he is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing in him, we may have life in his name. And so John is already telling us that this book demands a response. And I wonder what your response will be as we go through this series. So, like I said, today we're going to look a bit more closely about the first sign in John's Gospel, and it's in John 2, verses 1 to 12. Feel free to read if you've got Bibles or follow it on the screen. I'm going to read it for us. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used for Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you have saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. I'm just going to have a sip of water. Sorry. Not wine, no. Can always trust someone to make that quip. So, previously in John, we're just going to dig a little bit into this story, but I want to do a brief kind of what's happened before this. So the first chapter of John, like we said, is like a big arrow pointing to what to expect from the rest of the book. And in that first chapter, we see Jesus called these seven names. Like I said, we've got this theme of seven running through John's gospel. And he's called the Lamb of God, the Messiah, the Son of God, the King of Israel, Rabbi, Son of Man, Jesus of Nazareth. And these are big claims. They're really big claims. And as we go through, the signs start to add weight to these claims of who Jesus is. And we start to see for ourselves some of the transformation that he brings. Immediately prior to this story that we've just read, Jesus has called his disciple Nathanael, and there's a really interesting interaction between them. He uses an image to say to Nathanael, you're basically, in essence, he says to Nathanael, he recognizes him as the Son of God and as the Messiah. He says to Nathanael, you're going to see heaven touching earth. And this image is an image that refers back to a vision that Jacob saw way back in Genesis. And after he'd seen that vision, he called the place where he'd seen it Bethel. And that's not Bethel music for anyone that is a fan of that worship band, church. I don't know what you'd call it. But he called that place Bethel, which actually meant the, God's house, a place where God's presence dwelt. And so he was referencing this kind of sense of heaven touching earth. And here we see Jesus, God incarnate, in their midst, saying, you're going to see heaven touching earth. He is of God. He is God. And he is on earth. And John is setting out his stall there. He's setting out his stall, and he's saying, this is what you can come to expect when I'm around. When Jesus is around, this is what you can come to expect. And the very next thing we see after Jesus made this claim to Nathanael that you're going to see heaven touching earth is Jesus performing a miracle in Nathanael's hometown. Cana is Nathanael's hometown. It doesn't say that here, but it says it later in John. So we've got this sense that when Jesus is around, something changes and something is different. And so this wedding, this story even, is about a wedding, some water and some wine. And there's so many things that I could say about this story, but we're just going to focus on a few things today. And the things we're going to focus on are that Jesus has the power to transform our present, our past, and our future. My slide hasn't come up there. It looks like I've just not put the M properly on that transform, but you get what I'm saying. So how does Jesus transform our present? What do we learn from this story? In this passage, we see that Jesus is in this really everyday human situation. I'm guessing that most of us in here will have been to a wedding, or at least been to an evening do, if not a full, if not a full thing. And it's quite a familiar situation. We see that there's this host that is either under-catered for his guests, or he's got very, very greedy guests. And like today, part of hosting would have been being able to demonstrate something of your social status, and it would have been really, really, really bad form not to have enough wine or food for your guests. And I don't know whether you have ever been in that situation where you've had people over for dinner and you realise there's this dawning moment where you're like, there's not. There isn't going to be enough. And you're thinking, why didn't I go to Sainsbury's and get some extra? Or someone extra has turned up that you weren't expecting to be there. And you're giving yourself like the smallest plate of food possible. And like when someone says, oh, why aren't you eating much? Oh, I'm not very hungry. Had a big lunch. Actually, there's just not enough to go round. It's like one of those social faux pas that you never want to happen, isn't it? It's the sort of thing that, you know, if you were going to have like a restless night's sleep and you have those repetitive dreams, it's the sort of thing that you might have one of those dreams about, isn't it? Just like not being able to have enough food. So we can kind of all relate to that sense. But what we see is that in the midst of this very ordinary situation, Jesus has compassion on the wedding host. He meets them in their need. He meets them in a miraculous and abundant way. And I mean, when we read about the jars, when that word jars for me, I like think of jam jars. Do you know what I mean? Like little jam jars. But actually, they were like huge jars. There was like 120 to 180 gallons worth of fluid in those jars. I mean, that is a stupid amount of wine, isn't it? That is just like an abundant amount of wine. And that's what Jesus did for that host. And that's an indication, really, of, I think that when we talk about layers in a story, for me, the layer in that story is that Jesus wants to give us a fullness of life. Later on in John's Gospel, in John 10:10, it says that I have come that you might have life and life in all its fullness. And that word life in the Bible, actually, in the Greek is Zoe. I really love that word. So I'm like, that's something my parents name me that because it's this abundance of life, that we have when we meet Jesus. And I wonder when the last time that you met Jesus was. When was the last time that Jesus met you in a time of need? Do you actually believe that Jesus can transform your present? I was just bowled over by that word that Miriam brought. And, you know, there is a picture there, wasn't there, from Isaiah of God rebuilding. And this time last year, I was in like a mess. My life was kind of like, I spoke about this in September. You know, I wasn't as probably open then as I can be now. But this time last year, I thought that I was going to be getting engaged and married in the next year. And that obviously hasn't happened. But that was exactly where I was about a year ago. And for various reasons, that just fell apart. And it's about a year ago. And at that time, I just could never imagine that things were going to be okay. I could never, ever imagine that things were going to be okay, but I knew that God had made me a promise that I would be okay. And it's that story of restoration, isn't it? And that picture that Jane brought, that sometimes we can't see the stuff that's going on. And, you know, last week I celebrated that a year on, I'm in a completely different place. And I know that that wasn't God's plan for me. I know that that wasn't what God wanted for me. And I was able to make a decision at that point a year ago to say no. Actually, this isn't right for me. And, you know, it can be really, really difficult to believe that Jesus still acts today on our behalf. And one of the interesting things in this story is that Jesus transformed this situation just by willing it. When you look at the story, there was no laying on of hands. There was not like some kind of sequence or abracadabra moment that happened. He didn't even have to say, I turn this water into wine. And in fact, when you read, we don't even realize that the water has been turned into wine until it's given to the master of the banquet. He drinks it and says, this is wine. And for me, when I saw that, it was really, really powerful because Jesus only had to will that to happen. And his will and his word is as powerful today as it was then. You know, Jesus isn't here with us now. He's not here and present in his physical form, but his will and his word are still able to act on our behalf. And he is alive, and he's promised to do greater things than this. But will we ask him? Will we take him at his word? And will we believe him like the disciples did? Like I said, every good story has layers. And so, as well as that very human provision that Jesus made, when we dig deeper into this story, we see that as well as transforming our present, Jesus also transforms our past. Now, the Jewish tradition of the day would have meant that in order to be in God's presence, people would have had to have made themselves ceremonially clean. And it references that in the story, doesn't it? It says that those jars were actually used for ceremonial washing. And I guess it was a symbol, that washing was a symbol of the way that the people of God had to deal with their sin, with the stuff that they'd done wrong. And what we see in this story, though, is that Jesus is hinting at what he's going to do through his death and resurrection. And in the story, if you notice it, it says, on the third day. On the third day. What else happened on the third day? On the third day, Jesus rose from the dead and showed himself to be able to be powerful enough to beat death. And the image of those jars being filled with water and yet being turned into wine hints at this radical transformation that God was going to, that Jesus was going to bring to the way that people dealt with the problem of sin. Rather than having to go through these rituals of making themselves clean through Jesus' death and resurrection, we're made clean once and for all. The wine in those jars points to the blood of Jesus that was shed on the cross. And you know, now his spirit lives in us. We're temples of God's presence. We don't have to go to a special place to experience Jesus, but we carry his spirit with us. And this story is a signpost of what was to come. And because of that, our past has been transformed. We can come before God without condemnation and able to seek forgiveness. And he makes us clean. And that is a massive privilege, and it's a privilege that was achieved only because of what Jesus did on the cross. That is powerful and transforming. So Jesus transforms our present and our past, but he also transforms our future. The very fact that this story includes a wedding is a really big clue for us as we make sense of what Jesus was trying to show us through this sign. It's another layer. And through the Bible image of the wedding, through the Bible, the image of the wedding banquet is used to describe what our future with God will look like. In Isaiah 25 in the Old Testament and in Revelation 21 in the New Testament, what we see is that wine and weddings are symbols of restoration and fullness of life that we will experience in eternity with God. And this symbol of the wine and the wine in the jars was more than just a great show. It was a great show. It was a great sort of demonstration of Jesus' power to transform. But it was also a signpost for us. You know, the idea of this being a wedding links with the image of Jesus as the bridegroom. And we, the church, are his bride. And one day, we'll enter the wedding banquet of all wedding banquets. We've got glimpses of that in Revelation 21. And you'll see in this story, in John 2, that the master of the banquet in the story, when he tastes the wine, he says to the bridegroom, "You've saved the best wine until last." This hints that for us, the best is yet to come. You know, one day, death has been defeated by Jesus, hasn't it? But one day we will live in eternity with him, and there'll be no more pain, no more tears, no more suffering. Everything will be made new, and we will live forever in God's presence. And Jesus was ushering in this new way of life for us, a way to enter into God's presence now, but also a way to experience fullness of life when this life finishes. And you know, when things are difficult and we face challenges, we need to cling to this promise of future transformation. Like Miriam was saying and Jane was saying this morning, there's times where we can't feel, we can't know, and always fully understand that this change and transformation is possible. But we know that it is happening and it will happen and it will continue to happen. It is forever that Jesus transforms us. So if Jesus transformed our past, our present, and our future, how will you respond? I want you to think, I should have asked you at the beginning to think of one thing that you would like Jesus to transform in your life. Just take a moment to think of that one thing. So bearing that one thing in mind, will you, like the disciples, believe in him today and trust him for that transformation? I'm going to pray for us and then hand over to Andy. Jesus, we thank you for that sign that you performed 2,000 years ago at that wedding. in that very human event. And Jesus, we thank you that you still act by your will and by your power. And so, God, I ask that you would do that for us today. We bring all of these things that are in our hearts and in our minds that we're looking to you for transformation for. And Jesus, we trust that you will act on our behalf. Amen.